You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of The Big Red Flag by Joy Press. For much of its existence, Scholastic was known mostly for its magazines. The first, founded in 1920, and then School Book Clubs, an arena it entered in 1948. Surely many readers will remember the buzz that whirred through the classroom whenever Scholastic Book Club catalogs were passed out. Teachers were happy to encourage purchases. Not only was it getting kids excited about reading, but classrooms could earn bonus books as a commission. Many of the titles in those early book club catalogs were licensed from other publishers. Norman Bridwell's Clifford the Big Red Dog, first published in 1963, was one of the company's few homegrown classics. But Robinson had an ambition vision. He had an ambitious vision. And when he took over from his father, he began creating an ecosystem. In the 1980s, the company bought up a bunch of small regional book fair companies. Scholastic built a direct relationship with millions of students, encouraging them to browse at the book fairs and make their own choices, something kids rarely got to do. It also gave the company huge power within the children's book industry. Publishers who wanted to get their books into students' hands often had to license paperback rights to Scholastic. For authors, it was a tempting proposition. Even little-known writers could sell bajillions of copies. Next photo, among the literati, Dick Robinson and Iole Lucchese attend a black tie gala for the Penn Foundation in 2019. Between the book clubs and the book fairs, Scholastic, which went public in 1992, NASDAQ, SCHL, suddenly had a near monopoly on the grade school market, turning the seemingly dowdy arena of children's books into a cash cow. Robinson kept an eye trained on the future, developing educational software, computer magazines, interactive projects, a television production wing, and a pioneering foray online, launching the Scholastic Network on AOL in 1993. By the mid-1990s, Robinson had created such a vibrant brand that Ted Turner approached him about partnering on a 24-hour Scholastic cable network for kids. He turned it down, according to a former employee close to the deal, because Robinson feared sharing control with another entity, potentially diluting the Scholastic name. Yet being a public company sometimes complicated Robinson's earnest literacy mission. It was a family company until it became a stock market company, says Rebecca Barrera. A former educator who sat on the Scholastic board for 13 years before serving as director of Hispanic initiatives. I saw it transforming over the years. There was a lot of pressure by those who held stock. The one area where Scholastic lagged was publishing original books. In order to further dominate the children's market, Robinson kickstarted the publishing division by hiring Barbara Marcus, Richard Crinsley, and Jean Fiol, who became president of children's books publishing and distribution, executive vice president and president of the book group, and editorial director, respectively. When Marcus arrived in 1983, the company's children's book division was bringing in revenues of about $120 million. By the time she left in 2005, that had shot up to $1.3 billion, becoming a major profit center for the company. During that time, Scholastic solidified a trade books program that worked hand in hand with the company's book clubs and fairs, all of which Marcus oversaw. At the time, there was no children's bestseller list, says Fiewel, so to be able to get a sense of what children responded to on a monthly basis was like a miracle. The clubs were a monster that needed constant feeding. In 1986, after noticing that a story about a teen babysitter was a perpetual book club favorite, Fiewel says she asked former editor Anne M. Martin to flesh out an idea for a monthly paperback series on the topic. With the Babysitter's Club, Fiewel says, Martin literally spoke to something in the zeitgeist about girls and their friendship and their autonomy, being on their own, making their decisions, running a business. At a time when children's paperback originals were not taken seriously enough to review, the Babysitter's Club was a massive success. Over the next 14 years, it sold 176 million copies and was adapted into a 1990 HBO series, which Netflix recently rebooted. Next, photos, family matters. Helen Benham, Robinson, and their sons. Benham and Robinson on Martha's Vineyard, summer 2020. The Magic School Bus, one of Scholastic's early hardcovers, emerged from one editor's brainstorm. Why not slip science curriculum into fun storybooks? Fiewel recalls an editor from another publishing house dismissing the idea. You can't teach science with a fictional character. That's not done. But the New York Times compared Magic School Bus to the revolutionary power of Sesame Street. Still, it was hard to get top literary agents' attention. They were like, you're just a book club, you do shitty-looking books, and we're not interested, Fiewel recalls. The company decided to build a prestige publishing program from scratch, hiring ambitious young editors like Bonnie Verberg and Arthur A. Levine. Verberg brought in respected children's authors like Virginia Hamilton, Cynthia Rylant, and Leo and Diane Dillon, and would go on to publish popular series like Captain Underpants, No David, and Poppleton. Levine had published Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass while he was an editor at Knopf, and had two Caldecott-winning picture books under his belt. In 1997, Levine brought home a manuscript from the Bologna Children's Book Fair that he desperately wanted to buy. It was about a young boy named Harry Potter. Bidding against nine other publishers, Levine began to lose hope that he could acquire the book by a fledgling writer named J.K. Rowling. But every time the auction price went up, Barbara Marcus approved the deal without second-guessing. Marcus and Fiewel were really putting their money where their mouth was, says Levine, to make Scholastic a name to be reckoned with. The book so wowed everyone in-house that Marcus decided to bring Rowling to the U.S. for a pre-publication tour. That's when the author first met Robinson, who introduced himself at a morning event for her on Scholastic's roof. Some days later, she got a voicemail from him on her hotel phone. I'm not going to lie to you. I hadn't read your book. But after you read that scene about Harry getting his wand, I thought, I want to know what happens next, she recalled, during a tribute to Robinson after his death. He'd gone away and devoured the whole book, and he wanted her to know he loved it. The company continues to support Rowling, even as her transphobic comments have upset many Harry Potter fans. Scholastic is committed to supporting and amplifying the work of LGBTQIA+ creators, including transgender and non-binary voices, says a representative in the only statement Scholastic offered in response to questions related to this story. For decades, J.K. Rowling's writing has been an entry point for children to become excited about reading. We respect her right to express personal opinions. As Potter morphed into a worldwide phenomenon, it changed the company and made it more visible, Robinson told the New York Times in 2005. But what everybody feels the most about Harry Potter is that it brought kids to the reading process who had never been readers. The success of the series also put enormous pressure on Scholastic to not just meet fiscal expectations, but exceed them every year. How can you reliably repeat a supernova like Harry Potter? Everything about Harry was original and groundbreaking, says Fiewel, and it ruined us, frankly. The success was just exponential to where the last book, I think the first printing, sold out in 24 hours. It set the bar so high for us and everybody else to not only want a bestseller, but to want a phenomenon every year. The downside of a business run like a family is that someone gets to preside as the patriarch, or far less often, matriarch. The company did what Dick wanted to do, end of the story, says a recent Scholastic employee. It was his private fiefdom. Just like a royal court, it could feel like everything revolved around gaining Robinson's favor. Louis XIV analogies came up in multiple interviews, while one longtime executive affectionately compared Robinson to a benevolent dictator. Once Lucchese became part of the inner circle, company politics got even more complicated, according to several sources. I think that she had a very big influence and used it, says one former employee who worked closely with Robinson for many years. She didn't want anybody around that was close to Dick, people who might have had some influence over him. Starting around 2005, Robinson split up Marcus's domain, with the trade books, clubs, and fairs divisions, each now controlled by different managers. Marcus had just become too powerful in the company, one former employee told me, a belief echoed by several other former colleagues. Dick didn't want one of his underlings to have that much power. The dream team scattered to the winds, with Marcus now president and publisher at Random House Children's Books, and Fiewel reigning over her own Macmillan imprint, Fiewel and Friends. A series of beheadings followed over the next decade and a half, in which older courtiers were ousted. Others interpret these corporate reorgs as motivated less by the desire to eliminate rivals with sway over Robinson and more to do with cost-cutting. The ruthless excision of veteran executives with high salaries. Scholastic was always crammed with talented women, mostly white women, with a few exceptions, in positions of power, but over the years, a flood of longtime high-powered female executives left or were pushed out. Most went quietly. Others registered a sense of injustice. According to publicly available court filings, Verberg, who worked at Scholastic for 27 years and founded its high-end imprint, the Blue Sky Press, filed a 2019 suit in the Southern District of New York, alleging age and gender discrimination. The suit notes that Verberg was told, "At your age, you're lucky to have a job," among other insults, in a discussion of promotion for the How Do Dinosaurs Say Goodnight series that Verberg acquired. She was told she could pose as the grandmother of a dinosaur. The complaint says that Robinson told her she was being let go in June 2019 without cause. When Verberg asked whether Scholastic was terminating any other employees, Robinson quickly admitted that the company had decided to terminate other older employees, according to the suit, which also alleges that Scholastic paid multiple male employees with the same title and position more money, even when she had seniority. In the documents, Scholastic denied all the allegations. According to a source close to Scholastic, the case has been resolved. One of the main things at Scholastic was the carpet, says a former executive. Printed over and over on it was Scholastic's credo and editorial platform, penned by founder Maurice Robinson, which in part declared the company's belief in the worth and dignity of each individual, respect for the diverse groups in our multicultural society, and high moral and spiritual values. The executive recalls, "Most of us who worked there, we stayed there in spite of what went on, because we believed in the carpet." Dick Robinson's history of blurring boardroom and bedroom started with his first wife, Catherine Woodruff Robinson, described by former colleagues as prim, shy, and brilliant. Catherine met Dick when they were both editors in the magazine division, and they married in 1968. While he moved up to a more executive role, Catherine became the editor of Scope, the magazine Dick had founded, and kept its circulation numbers high. The couple did not have children, and eventually they split. Robinson began dating Benham, who had already been at the company for more than a decade. A dynamic former schoolteacher, Benham had started in the art department and moved around the company and up the ladder, developing a program for children with special needs and successfully overhauling Scholastic's remedial reading publications and elementary school weekly magazines, among other roles. So here's Dick, very openly having an affair with a woman who will become his next wife, within 150 feet of his ex-wife, says Lee Kravitz, a former editorial director of Scholastic. That tension is felt on some level throughout the whole floor. And I remember just thinking, this is a family company that produces stuff for children? Kravitz recalls, "Our sense of Helen and Dick as the dynastic family became vivid the moment Ben was born, and Dick was happy." For Benham and Robinson, their work and personal lives blended into one. Sometimes they brought Ben to the office, where he'd be entertained by fellow employees, while Benham's team delved into a whole new area for Scholastic, a division devoted to early childhood. She founded the magazines Early Childhood Today for teachers, and Parent and Child for parents, and pulled together a national early childhood advisory board with leaders in an array of fields, including Bruno Bettelheim and Stanley Greenspan. It truly was a family affair, with Benham's mother, Virginia, drafted to manage the advisory board and organize an annual conference. Benham says the ideas that emerged from the division had real-world effects within the company, too. She proposed the company's expanded paid parental leave policy based on what she had absorbed from child-rearing expert T. Barry Brazelton, M.D. In 1996, Benham gave birth to a second son, Reese, named for his grandfather, Maurice. People within the company sometimes ask the young boys when they were going to take over the business. People treated them like princes, a former employee says, with clear affection. The minute people saw them, they started fawning, and I thought, please, you're going to make me puke. As parents, Dick and I encouraged our sons to pursue their own passions and interests, and to not feel obligated to join the company, Benham says. But given that both of us were committed to Scholastic, the company was in their blood, so to speak. Ben, now 35, is an aspiring writer who runs a sawmill and workshop on the vineyard, while Reese has embarked on a fledgling career as a filmmaker. In the last few years, As Dick returned to the family, Ben and Reese were finally free to express their interest in being part of the company's future, Benham says. We had many discussions about how to carry on Scholastic's original mission, to reignite the youthful energy and creativity which had driven the company. Dick was very receptive to our ideas and to having his sons involved in the company, and they wanted that too. Little did they imagine that they would soon be severed from the company's future. Some colleagues of Robinson's have suggested that he dated employees at Scholastic because the company was his whole world. It's true that the children's books ecosystem was disproportionately populated by women, partly because it was the less prestigious end of publishing, and partly because educating and entertaining children traditionally have been seen as women's work. In the 1970s, a boss dating a subordinate might have been seen as acceptable, if unprofessional. By the 1990s, though, it was considered improper. That's when Robinson is said to have embarked on a multi-decade romance with Lucchese, an employee in the Canadian outpost of Scholastic. The company told the Journal that it advises employees on the risk of dating subordinates and co-workers, but doesn't prohibit such relationships. The child of working-class Italian immigrants in Toronto, Lucchese began there in 1991 as an associate book club editor soon after graduating from college and met Robinson early in her tenure. She rose through the ranks to become co-president of Scholastic Canada by 2004. Robinson and Benham divorced in 2003, and Benham stayed employed by Scholastic until 2005. One former colleague recalls it as a very ugly and unpleasant, but sort of unsurprising situation, because he had chosen Helen as his partner in the same way that he was now leaving Helen. By 2014, Robinson had named Lucchese Scholastic's chief strategy officer, and she began spending more time in New York. Colleagues say they were clearly a couple. It was so obvious, you might as well put big red I love you signs on the front of them, says a former employee, who believes that Lucchese didn't want the relationship publicly acknowledged. Everything had to be a secret, and it was so tiring because it immediately started being evident. According to numerous sources, it became even more evident when Lucchese began publicly criticizing and belittling Robinson in front of staff. No one was allowed to talk to him the way she did sometimes. She started being a little bit more testy with him in public. She thought he was old-fashioned and that he didn't handle people well. Iole presented herself as the power, not the person who had the power's ear, says another colleague. By granting so much authority to someone he was involved with, say people who worked with them, Robinson threw the balance of the place out of whack, regardless of Lucchese's talents. The whole company revolved around having Dick love you, a high-level former executive points out. So you can see why, if he's got his girlfriend in charge, it would be in people's self-interest to be warm toward her. Not only was Robinson besotted with a younger woman, says a source who worked with him for years, but he changed himself to be more appealing to her, and she dictated what that meant. He started wearing these tight little boy suits. He didn't pay a whole lot of attention to his looks until she was in his life. Robinson was focused on what Iole needed all the time, even if that meant sending underlings out in the snow to pick up her favorite flowers or stock the office with food she liked. She continued to wield power even after the couple broke up in early 2019, according to colleagues. The thing is, the corporate world has long resembled a giant glass treehouse with a "No Girls Allowed" sign hung out in front in invisible ink. There were just 41 women on the Fortune 500 in 2021. One way for a woman to penetrate the inner sanctum of the C-suite has been to marry a mogul if she can't be born to one or muscle her way in. It might set people gossiping, but it doesn't mean she can't do the job. Trying to find out what Lucchese has accomplished at Scholastic has been difficult, though, since neither she nor those currently in the company will speak in specifics. Her bio says she has worked to modernize Scholastic for the digital age, forge new and innovative partnerships, and extend the company's reach to diverse audiences, focusing on content development and the strengthening of the Scholastic brand in publishing and education. The Wall Street Journal reported that Lucchese played an advisory role in the development of Storia, an e-reader app that failed, but a source close to the company now says she never led the initiative. She is said, however, to have taken charge of attempts to digitally streamline the company, as well as launched an electronic gift card strategy. The company's divisions were so siloed that even executives who'd worked alongside her were unsure of what her brief was at certain times. One told me she was a smart marketer who had done well with Canada's book clubs and played a role in some Canadian success stories, including that of best-selling author Robert Munsch. She also has a reputation as a brilliant strategist who prefers to stay behind the scenes. When strategy changes happened, they never had Lucchese's name attached to them. She was invisible, one source says. Many within the company could not imagine Robinson leaving those crucial shares to her simply because they imagined she does not want to be front and center. The one power center Lucchese has openly embraced is Hollywood. In 2018, she added President of Scholastic Entertainment to her other titles. Entertainment had been a small but crucial part of the company since the 1980s. In its early years, the company produced made-for-TV movies and the CBS sitcom Charles in Charge, but eventually shifted to adapting Scholastic works like Clifford the Big Red Dog, Magic School Bus, Goosebumps, and Animorphs. Even if the entertainment projects themselves didn't directly funnel huge profits to Scholastic, the exposure made book sales spike. That was also true of projects that Scholastic didn't have a hand in producing, like the Harry Potter and Hunger Games movies, since the popularity of the films led to the kind of book sales publishers could only imagine in their wildest dreams. Scholastic is in a very interesting position if they can figure out how to do this really strategically. That's the key to the entire business these days. Whoever controls the intellectual property has the control, says a talent agent who specializes in literary intellectual property. And a $30 million film campaign is a great piece of marketing for their book. So Hollywood and publishing have become sort of mutually reliant on each other in a way that you've never seen in the history of intellectual property. Scholastic's vast archive of children's classics looks increasingly like a treasure trove of potential franchises. So perhaps it makes sense that Lucchese jumped enthusiastically into learning about Hollywood, making regular visits to L.A. to meet people, and overseeing project development and production. Clifford the Big Red Dog producer Jordan Kerner says Lucchese was on the set of the 2021 live-action movie nearly every day, ensuring that the film was staying true to author Norman Bridwell's vision. I think she was really learning from the folks in visual effects and special effects and production design, and would also offer up her opinions on wardrobe or casting in every area of the film. And it was welcome. She never said, "This is what should be done." She always said, "Have you thought about this or that? Or is there a way of working in this thing or that thing?" And it was said with a hug and laughter or warmth. Lucchese learned everyone's name on set, Kerner says, just as Robinson once had within the company. She is now engaged to Clifford's visual effects supervisor, Blair Clark, a relationship she kept so private that Kerner didn't find out until they were on the red carpet for the Clifford premiere in New York in November. I didn't know, he says with a laugh. And by the way, she and I would talk all the time. As Lucchese finds her footing as chair, the question of Robinson's will looms. The belief among some close to him is that Robinson had intended to rewrite his will, which was last updated in 2018. My grandfather started the company over a century ago, and my dad subsequently dedicated his life to its international growth. Given that my mother also worked there, I grew up deeply entrenched in Scholastic, says Ben Robinson, whose name is a shortening of his mother's, Benham. It's almost impossible to fathom life without my father and the cherished connection I shared with the company, which served as my third parent. Ben and Reese have not formally contested the will, says a source close to the family, but they also have not waived the right to do so. The Wall Street Journal reported that Reese had signed a waiver. He told me the boys would be very well taken care of, says a former Scholastic executive who was close to Robinson, so it was very much a shock to me. I could see him leaving her stuff and leaving her money, but to leave her the company, A shares, was just mind-blowing to me. Another former employee notes that he had his sons very late in life, and they were very young. That person says, I think he had always hoped that Reese would take over, and I think he never thought he was ever going to die. Benham says now, I believe that I knew Dick very well, in all of his complexities and contradictions. She says that during the pandemic, Robinson came to many painful realizations, and that he expressed his regrets at the kitchen table the night before he died. Benham went on to say that it is heartbreaking that he died before correcting a devastating mistake he had made, something he most assuredly planned to do. Reese was the only family member to speak at Scholastic's virtual tribute to Robinson in September. He revealed how much he cherished the time they'd all spent with his dad, mentioning invigorating discussions of politics and literacy and the rise of disinformation. I studied business and worked in filmmaking with the encouragement of my dad, who thought I would someday become a part of the future of the business, Reese says now. During COVID, we often discussed strategic ideas for Scholastic's future. I was at the office almost daily, where he was the only one in. We were making plans to keep Scholastic in the family. Dick loved and greatly admired Ben and Reese and recognized their talents, many of which would well serve the company his own father founded, Benham says. He would have loved to have them work at the family company and eventually manage it. Those conversations were just getting started. The idea that Scholastic or Robinson would cut a dynastic thread is an act the family cannot reconcile. Timing, life, circumstances, mistakes, it all adds up to a tragedy, Benham says sadly. Someone who worked closely with Robinson for many years recalls an ongoing discussion with him about putting Reese on the board, despite his young age, but believes the father was worried about Lucchese's reaction. He was very much wanting to, but I think in the end he realized that if he did it, he was going to have all hell to pay. A source familiar with the board's deliberations counters, there was never any formal consideration to place Reese on the board. Robinson had seemed in denial at points about the eventual need to create a succession plan. He told the Wall Street Journal in 2013 that his own dad had sent him notes the day before he died with instructions on what to do with the company. "But I don't plan to do that," he said, admitting that he hadn't anointed a successor. He regularly evaded the topic with employees and even with Scholastic board members, although Warwick was appointed within 24 hours of Robinson's death. Lucchese told the New York Times that she was shocked by Robinson's decision to leave his Class A shares to her, but that Dick understood that I shared his passion for Scholastic and what this company means to the teachers we serve, to the children we serve, to everyone, and that he trusted me with that legacy. A longtime employee says she feels terrible for Lucchese because the way Robinson set things up leaves a cloud hanging over that authority. Ayol has put in the work. She's very smart, and she's very devoted to the company. I have to believe that he knew what he was doing because it meant everything to him. As for the cloud Robinson has left around himself and his legacy, a former Scholastic executive characterizes him as a hero to teachers and one of America's greatest media figures, someone who belongs on the Mount Olympus of publishers, and who, through dozens of modern classics, turned generations of children onto the pleasures of reading. And yet, she says with a sigh, this is how he will be remembered? Thank you. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Isaac Mizrahi, the designer and author on loyalty, love, and his long-lost drag career. What is your idea of perfect happiness? I've discovered that I have no happiness other than my dogs. If they are happy, I'm happy. That sounds like something my mother used to say about her children, which I always thought was slightly manipulative and way overstated. I was wrong. What is your greatest fear? That I will be taken for mad and thrown into a 19th-century-esque insane asylum and never be heard from again? Which living person do you most admire? Ricky Gervais. I'm saying that so he might read this and cast me in something. What is your favorite occupation? Working, eating carbs, playing bridge. I wish more people would play. It's getting harder and harder to find a fourth. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Work. I like working more than people, more than relationships. Also New York City, which never disappoints. What is your greatest regret? When I was 10, I began doing female impersonations. By the time I was 12, I had an entire repertoire. I could do Judy Streisand, Dionne Warwick, Liza, Shirley Bassey. I regret so much having given that up. Had I continued, I might have had a real career as a drag performer. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I would come back as a smoker who didn't care about health. What is your greatest extravagance? My car and driver. Which talent would you most like to have? I wish I could dance en pointe and look great in tights. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Mark Twain. He was sophisticated in an exclusively American way. Also so quotable. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Madame Verdurin from Proust, In Search of Lost Time. I'm not sure she's a hero, but I admire her survivalist instincts. Also Adrian Leverkun from Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus, only for his dedication, his desperation to be great, to be relevant. Who are your heroes in real life? Dr. Fauci, Ricky Gervais, my astrologer. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Loyalty. I credit people for trying, but I think loyalty after a certain point is impossible. What is it that you most dislike? Cilantro. People who refer to themselves as foodies. The Met Ball. That would be sour grapes. Where would you like to live? I love living on 12th Street. When I first got the apartment, my mother said, if you want to stay young forever, move to the village. I would also love to have a place in Rome, if only to feel my age occasionally. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I would care less about what people thought of me. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I would make them Democrats. What is your motto? Never boring, never bored. What is your current state of mind? Hold, please. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Isaac Mizrahi. Mr. Weber's confession. Last year, veteran journalist Nancy Jo Sales got a strange call from Exeter, her high school alma mater. The elite boarding school was investigating an anonymous accusation of sexual misconduct, and the writer was the alleged victim. The problem? Sales says it never happened. Lolita is written as a confession, the confession of a white widowed male. In Nabokov's masterpiece, the narrator, Humbert Humbert, delivers his own unreliable account of the sorry and sordid business of his sexual exploitation of a 12-year-old girl. Though the reference here is inexact, it was Lolita I thought of when I heard that David Weber, my former teacher at Phillips Exeter Academy, had confessed to hugging and kissing me in the spring of 1982, when I was 17 and he was 38. During the course of an investigation begun in the fall of 2020, sparked by an allegation made by an anonymous third party, Weber told Exeter's lawyers at the international law firm Holland and Knight that he had hugged and kissed me once in the basement of a dormitory called Dutch House. There were no other allegations against Weber, who had been a beloved English teacher at the school for nearly 40 years before officially retiring in 2008. But after his confession, Exeter principal William K. Rawson sent an email to students and alumni, thousands of people, telling them that he had distressing information about sexual misconduct at the academy. Due to Weber's admission of hugging and kissing a student, Rawson wrote, his emeritus status has been removed, and he has been barred from the PEA campus and all Exeter events. I was not named in this email of February 15, 2021, but I was the student it was talking about, as Rawson and lawyers for the school confirmed to me. The thing is, I have no recollection of this alleged incident. I have no memory of Weber ever doing anything inappropriate with me, which I had made clear to Rawson, as well as Exeter's Director of Student Well-Being, Christina Palmer, and a detective from the Exeter Police. Despite my repeated denials, however, the Academy pressed on with its investigation of Weber, now 78, eventually sending the email that ruined his reputation. So why did he confess? And why did Exeter punish him, even though I said this never happened? As Nabokov says in the beginning of his novel, look at this tangle of thorns. I came to Exeter in the winter of 1981. I'd never set foot on the campus before. It looked like something out of a movie to me, with its pristine red brick buildings, more like a fancy college than a high school. My family had just moved to New Hampshire from Miami. My mother and stepfather, burned out on running a busy health food restaurant for 10 years, had decided to move to a small town in the White Mountains and open a cheese shop. So I was sent to boarding school for my last 3 semesters. Days after I arrived at Exeter, there was a snowstorm. I'd never seen snow. I energetically took part in a giant snowball fight in the courtyard outside my dorm, during which I developed a serious case of frostbite on my hands. No one had told me that when handling snowballs, you should wear gloves. Nobody in my family had ever gone to boarding school, so I arrived at Exeter unprepared in many ways. My father, trying to be helpful, had bought me a suitcase full of preppy classics from L.L. Bean, shirts with Peter Pan collars, knee-high socks, which wound up making me look like an embarrassing wannabe. The cool girls at Exeter wore threadbare corduroys, flannel shirts, and clogs so worn down the heels were just slivers of wood. I brought nothing so shabbily chic. I also didn't have the same level of academic training as my classmates, many of whom had been in private school since they could talk, and many of whom went on to become leaders in business, tech, academia, the arts. I'll never forget the look on the face of my French teacher when, feeling anxious and overwhelmed, I got up to leave his class, telling him, "Je suis mauvaise, I am evil. I had meant to say, je suis malade, I am sick." The teacher who made me feel like everything was going to be okay was David Weber. He encouraged me to write. I started churning out short stories to show him. Often I would visit him in the evenings in his study at Dutch House, where he lived with his wife and young daughter. The door always open, by the way, with other female students coming and going as part of check-in. He was the dorm head. I guess part of me felt like my lowly status was raised a bit by having this kind and well-liked teacher as my friend. And he was a good teacher. In retrospect, I see he was a kind of early editor. He was a pivotal person in my life, and I remembered him with gratitude, although after I graduated in 1982, we hadn't spoken. So that's why I was stunned when on September 10th, 2020, I got a call from Palmer asking me brusquely, after a few pleasantries, "When you were a student at Exeter, did you have a sexual relationship with Mr. Weber?" She advised me it would be best if I could be brief, as she only had a few minutes for this conversation. I felt a wave of nausea. I put a hand on the wall to steady myself. It wasn't Weber I was remembering, suddenly. It was the college boy who had raped me in a dorm room at the University of Miami when I was 14 years old, an experience I had only just begun to process some 40 years later. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.